I want to acknowledge that we're on Noongar land before I start to speak, and particularly today to acknowledge the Noongar women who have lived and loved and worked on this land for thousands and thousands of years. I am going to talk about a really, really awful piece of the Bible today. It's got appalling violence, particularly violence against women. If this talk is causing you distress, I need you to look after yourself first. Whatever you need to do right now. If you need to walk out the room, if you need to call a friend who's not here, if you need to grab someone who's in the room for support, particularly if you're someone who sexual violence or abuse is part of your story or the story of people you love. If you don't want to listen to this talk, if you're finding the talk overwhelming as we go, my invitation is to this image, to sink yourself into that as your space today. This is an image by George Sutakawa, who painted in 1947, and for me it's an image of God. Just to give an idea, how many people did read the passage in Judges in advance, so I know how? Okay, so a reasonable... Okay. So I'm going to summarise the story to start, and then I'll talk about it. So the story we have is that a Pilagesh has the courage to leave her so-called husband and flee home to her family in Bethlehem. Now, the word Pilagesh can either mean an esteemed second wife or a concubine in a harem. And the word's probably used intentionally ambiguously because we are left to determine if she's treated as a spouse or a sex slave. And the man comes after her. The language used is the language that he's going to charm her back, and it reads like a domestic violence textbook. There's the cycle of the perpetrator, violence, distance, and then a wooing charm to regain control. And her father attempts to delay him. Perhaps her father has a sense this his daughter won't be safe with this man. But he takes his Pilagesh and he leaves. There's not enough time for him to get home before dark, so he turns in at a town for shelter. He doesn't want to turn in at a non-Jewish town, so he goes a little bit further and turns in at the Benjaminite town of Gibeah. But the Gibeans don't offer hospitality. Eventually, an Ephraimite who lives there takes them in for the night. During the night, the Gibeans come to the door and demand that the male traveller be sent out so they can rape him. But the host says no and offers to send out his young daughter instead. Some versions of the text say he also offers the visiting Pilagesh. But the Gibeons refuse that offer. So the traveller physically grabs his Pilagesh and shoves her out the door to them. She is gang raped through the night and left for dead, and she collapses on the doorstep. In the morning, the traveller seeks to leave and only then notices the woman. And he orders her up. When she doesn't respond, he loads her onto his donkey and heads off for home. The text does not say she's dead. The text says she doesn't respond. When he gets home, he dismembers her, quite possibly murdering her himself. And he sends her body in pieces to the 12 tribes of Israel to accuse the Gibeons of an atrocity. He tells Israel that the Gibeons tried to kill him, and he implies that they took his woman from him by force. So in response, the tribes of Israel wage a war on Benjamin, and they almost wipe them out completely. And the text claims that God condones this mass slaughter. It also says the 25,000 Benjaminites who died were all of them very brave men. This is the men who are defending their brother's rights to destroy a woman. Israel hunts down the last ones, but a small remnant escapes into the desert. Then Israel returns and burns all the Benjaminite towns and kills all the livestock, the people, and the text says, and anything that came in their path, which presumably means the women of Benjamin, because after the war, Israel starts to get quite upset because they realise Benjamin as a tribe is going to die out, presumably because there's no women left. And so they need to find wives for the remaining men of Benjamin, but they've made an apparently insurmountable vow that they can't give their daughters in marriage to Benjamin. So further crimes follow. Jabesh in Gilead chose not to participate in the war. So the people of Israel massacre that town, all the men and the married women, and they take the unmarried women and give them to Benjamin as wives. But it's not quite enough. So then the remaining Benjaminites are instructed to ambush an Israelite religious festival at Shiloh to kidnap the dancing girls, and they become Benjaminite wives. And the men of Shiloh were told not to reclaim their daughters. More time is given to describing the battle strategies in the Benjaminite War than to the experience of the woman who is raped and killed. Her voice is never heard. The kidnapped women who come to worship Yahweh at Shiloh, or the ones whose families were slaughtered in Jabesh, are really referred to as breeding sows rather than humans in the narrative. It's important to clarify that the crime of Gibeah is not gay sex. They call for a male traveller to rape, but male rape is an extreme way to control and shame a man in this culture, probably committed by heterosexual men. It's got nothing to do with consensual homosexual relationships. That is an unbelievably awful story. So just pay attention to yourself for a moment to see where that is hitting you. And allow yourself some kindness as you absorb that. Because it's awful, but it's not actually unbelievable. Because women are treated as possessions, raped, discarded, murdered, controlled, and silenced every day. And that's just in our country, let alone around the world. In this story, the men have total control and the women are silenced. The raped woman is found with her hands on the doorstep, which is an image of having sought help from her host or from her husband, but she receives no help. And her so-called husband retells the story to the nation in a way that makes himself, rather than her, the victim. Does that sound familiar? So why is this story in our sacred text? Why? Just because it's in there doesn't mean that the author or any later editors condoned the story, and that's a really important thing to note. It is remarkable that people have not erased this story from their history. Now, this could reflect a complete insensitivity to the horrors of the story, but it could also reflect a courageous ability to not ignore the worst pieces of the past, not create a glorified narrative. This is not an Anzac legend. This is a description of the senseless destruction of war. It's within the Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings section, which together are a series of books that combine ancient tales of Israel's origin stories, and they've been edited together, probably in exile in Babylon. Our Bible puts the book of Ruth between Judges and Samuel, but really Judges flows into Samuel. Although having this story, this is the last chapter of Judges, having this story immediately preceding Ruth does give quite an alarming context for the decisions that the women in the book of Ruth make. Judges as a book particularly shows the descent into disarray that follows Israel entering into Canaan and trying to set themselves up there as the promised land. They have no particular governing structure, and they become increasingly influenced by the Canaanite locals. Key to this passage is that it starts and ends with the statement, "In those days there was no king in Israel." The end of Judges 21, the last verse, which is the last verse of the whole book of Judges, is, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did as they saw fit." So it seems somehow this story is presenting the depths of depravity that result, either because there's no king or because everyone did what was right in their own mind. And the variety then of commentators is to say what they thought exactly was the problem that was being demonstrated by the story of horror. But everyone pretty much agrees that they didn't put it in there because they thought it was an example to follow. It's a "this is how bad things get" story to warn people we have to make sure that this never happens again. In the final scene at Shiloh, the very same acts that were considered enough of a crime to launch a civil war are actively encouraged by Israel's elders. The taking of women by force and the overruling of the supposed rights of the men of Shiloh to determine what happened to their women. The very men who were the rapists at Gibeah could have been among the survivors given the instruction to kidnap women at Shiloh. I shudder to think what sort of lives those women were heading for. The collapse of society is complete. So despite the image of peace presented by everyone going home, the story suggests that this peace is a sham. So what then is the problem that this story is an illustration of how bad things get if? Perhaps the problem is not listening to Yahweh. The man whose Pilgash is murdered is a Levite. This is supposedly the people who liaise with God on behalf of the people. But he shows no sign at all of caring what God thinks or what God wants. The warring tribes, they call on Yahweh as an afterthought to justify what they've already decided to do. They throw together a few religious rituals, but they don't really seem inclined to pay attention to Yahweh within that. And then they have the affront to blame Yahweh for the consequences of their actions. So this could be a story where the message is this is what happens when we stop listening to God. And in this vein, Christian interpreters have taken it to mean this is how bad humans get without God, and this is why we need Jesus to save us. It could possibly be that this passage is part of the argument for why Israel needs a king. In 1 Samuel, the first chapters of 1 Samuel show that the existence of a monarchy is really controversial, at least at the start. We kind of inherit this David, the glorious king, kings are a great thing story, which is the narrative that wins, really. But there's strong evidence that there's two competing traditions in here. And a story like this gives a really strong argument for central, enforceable leadership as what we need. Interestingly, over the history of theology, this sort of interpretation has been really popular in eras when government felt under threat from a revolution. And it puts up the idea that the only two options are anarchy spiralling into violent chaos or strong centralised rulership under the existing powers. And the article that Karen sent around, I don't know if you read the Richard Cohen article that Karen sent a link to from last year, had that kind of a flavour to it. This is a story that tells us we must have strong leadership and centralised authority. But who should be the king? Who's the right king? And in 1 Samuel, there's Saul and there's David, and there's clearly traditions that are pro-Saul and pro-David that have come together in the book that we've got. Supposedly, Samuel anoints them both and changes allegiance between one and the other. That's probably an edit to try and hold these traditions together. But it's not clear which side this text is supporting. So consider some things and maybe you can decide. David was from Bethlehem, the town of the Pilgash's home. Saul was a Benjaminite from Gibeah. Saul's very first act as king, when the people are not really sure if they want a king at all and if they want him, is to rescue Jabesh Gilead from the Ammonites, which is in 1 Samuel 11, if you're keen to look things up. To rescue them, Saul cuts up his oxen and sends the pieces through Israel to call them to battle. And they do come, and they fight for Jabesh Gilead, and they save them. It's very clear that this is an intentional echo, because that's not a common practice that's throughout the ancient Near East culture. That's a very unusual thing. After that battle, people who were already loyal to Saul say, look how great he is. Anyone who wasn't already, we should bring them together and slaughter them. And Saul says, no, we are not taking revenge on people who were not on my side already. Everyone come together and appoint, and they did the rituals then to anoint him as king. So again, it's this reversal of what happened in the last story. Saul and Jonathan, his son, eventually are killed in battle by the Philistines, and the Philistines cut their heads off and send them around to all the tribes of Philistine to declare their victory. But the people of Jabesh Gilead, the people who were not roused to war by the dismembering of the Pilagesh, are roused to war by the dismembering of Saul and Jonathan, and they go into battle to bring their bodies home. So is this the image of reversal? Is this a pro-Saul text saying, in the Saul of Gibeah, the horrors of the Benjaminite wars are put behind us? Or is this a pro-David text saying, Saul is a Benjaminite from Gibeah and we can never trust him? He's part of an evil inheritance, and doesn't matter what he does to try and cover it up, don't trust him. It also shows that Saul of Gibeah almost certainly had family ties to Jabesh Gilead, because 2/3 of the women who founded the tribe of Benjamin were from that town. There's other reversal echoes. The last chapter of Judges is this festival at Shiloh where the women are kidnapped. The first chapter of Samuel is also a festival at Shiloh featuring women. Only that time it's Hannah and Peninnah, the two wives of Elkanah. And here the second wife, Hannah, is loved. And her prayers are answered, and she becomes the mother of Samuel. Those two stories come one after the other in this way the text line up. Other interpreters say this is a story to say peace is found without a king. That peace comes from the judicious transfer of women by men to create peace. And so that this is a cautionary tale, a patriarchal cautionary tale, about what happens when women act autonomously outside of male power. Because the Pilagesh, the whole thing starts when she leaves her husband. And there's a phrase given to explain her reason for leaving that can either mean she left because she was very angry, or that she left because she sexually betrayed her husband. And whatever she actually did, it's likely that the act of leaving is considered a sexual betrayal, even if she just went home to her family. An uncomfortable number of commentators really care whether she was unfaithful to her husband or not, as if that makes a difference to what happened to her. As if one answer to that question would justify this text. It is a theological form of she was asking for it. And in preparing for this text, I have to say the thing I found hardest was reading commentators who had a she was asking for it tone. It's just appalling. The use of the ambiguous phrase that could mean either of those things invites readers to blame the woman. The woman acts outside of male control and nearly brings down the whole nation. And peace is only restored when women en masse are passed back into male control. As you can imagine, that interpretation is perhaps not from the 18th century when people were under threat of revolution. That's a bit more contemporary. Perhaps this is a story that's there to urge unity between the tribes of Israel. So it's a cautionary tale about not treating each other as family. There's two parallel four-month delays. Anywhere in the Bible, if you've got a parallel piece of time, it usually is a flag to say these two things should be considered together. There's a four-month delay between the Levite, the Pilagesh leaves, and he waits 4 months before he goes to fetch her. Benjaminites flee into the desert, and Israel waits 4 months before they launch the plan to get wives and bring them back into the fold. So somehow these two stories are meant to echo each other. Is this about showing a family unit that's divided and reunited? Although it's a disturbing tale of what the reunification means then, it just is so violent that the second time that peaceful ending is perhaps a bit scary. The visitors at Gibeah should have received hospitality as family, but they were treated as outsiders, First, they were not welcomed at all, and then they were actively attacked. And in the Israelites going to war against Benjamin, they also treat them as outsiders. They use the language of holy war that is intended for the supposedly permitted wars against other people. And they do all this based on the Levites' calculated misinformation. So there's a unity that's based in a lie. And the dismembered Pilagesh symbolises Israel, torn to pieces. It's a test then of Israel's unity under the covenant, and Israel fails the test. Possibly even we're getting an image of Israel in this period as a family wrought by domestic violence, by coercive control, by complete dysfunction. Or perhaps more generally, this is a tale about the problem of the lack of hospitality. The Israelites at this time are an unwelcome colonising presence in a land surrounded by other people, and the hospitality code is really, really important to their survival. They need to look after each other. It echoes the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, where there too, sacred cities, the cities who refuse the sacred duty of hospitality are destroyed by avenging angels. The host in this story does nothing to protect the Pilagesh. The host is complicit in the Levites' violence. The town fails its duty to offer lodgings and then progresses to active abuse. This is the grossest violation of hospitality codes. By choosing a Jewish town, they should have saved themselves, but instead, choosing a Jewish town rather than a Canaanite town condemned them. So the story shows Israel as indistinguishable from their Canaanite neighbours, or possibly even worse than them. When the whole story of Joshua into Judges is that Israel was meant to be set apart as a holy example of living in response to Yahweh. All of that is useful to help us grapple with the how and why of this text. But what if we are not meant to be finding elaborate excuses for the painful parts of the Bible? What if being disturbed is the point? And I've found the writings of Phyllis Trible really useful around this, particularly her book Texts of Terror, which if you're interested, it's a thin book, it's worth a read. It's from 1984, it's around. Phyllis Trible warns that it is a falsehood to see stories of biblical violence as outdated or primitive because our world is still full of violence. And she also calls it perverse to redeem the stories by giving them a Jesus wash and saying the cross has fixed everything. Notice what has happened this morning. The more I have talked, the more invisible the women have become. Explaining these stories does not stand with the women in their trauma and can actually serve to erase them. But I believe this passage is God's subversive way of carrying victims of violence into a time when they can be properly mourned and the evil deeds against them be repented of. I think our job with a text like this is to say their name. Somehow the silenced women of this text now in the 21st century are given a voice because we give them voice. We hear the silent cries of a woman whose husband master was so awful she ran away from him only to be recaptured and then thrown to a violent mob. We see her hands on the threshold of our doors and we have a choice. Do we open the door to her story, to the cost of caring for her against a culture that says she is worthless? Or do we turn away? In the last few weeks and months, this woman's sisters have knocked on the doors of Australia. And they have asked to be heard. And they know that there is a risk they will be cut to pieces and sent to all corners of the nation. Because isn't that a description of how our media has treated women who challenge the patriarchy, who challenge structures of power that work against them? The ways that this story mirrors current Australian life make it brutally clear that the story in Judges reflects our reality, not an ancient bygone time. This is our time when men in power belittle or ignore women who've been raped in their workplace or perhaps even by their colleagues. This is our time when men take revenge on women who try to leave them by murdering them, by murdering their children, by desecrating their bodies. So to end, I want to speak directly to the women of this text. And you may wish to, in your heart, join with me. I might not make it through. Oh, courageous, violated women of Bethlehem. Oh, you murdered women of Benjamin. You massacred women of Jabesh-Gilead and your shattered daughters. You desecrated women at Shiloh. We see you. We see you. What happened to you was wrong. There is no excuse. We are deeply, deeply sorry for the abuse that you suffered, for your treatment as non-people, for the lives you were forced into, and for the violent ways that you died. We are sorry for the ways our tradition has hidden from your stories and even used them to perpetuate unjust power. We are so, so sorry that our world has not yet ceased the violence that you suffered. We pledge ourselves to work against violence and control of women in our day. Our tradition hands you to us unnamed, but we name you, and we commit to name all who come after you. You are our sister forever. You are precious one, whole and untainted. You are beloved of God. When you're ready, if you would like to ask questions or comment, feel free.
Changing everything you said, if the thought came to me that this is not the only story in the Bible that happened to women, and the other story, if I remember right, is it seems an abomination that people were treated in that way. And I put it to you as a possibility that because it was written a long time after the wars, that it was written as a justification for Israel going to war, and it may never have happened at all, but it may have been that they used this as an example of something that was really appalling to show how bad these people were, because you'll recall that in every recent war, the first thing that happens is we demonise the people we're going to kill. Because the only way we can kill people is to demonise them, whether it's the Germans in Belgium, whether it's the things they said about people in Vietnam and communists, or wherever it is, you always demonise the enemy. So years afterwards, they're justifying the fact that Israel is tearing itself to pieces in what amounted to a civil war.
It's absolutely a justification story. I think there's something that happened that they launched it from, simply because I don't think there's anything to be gained by inventing this story completely from nothing. If nothing like this had happened, then it wouldn't have been believable and it wouldn't have been held up. So whether there was these specific women or not, there were women in this situation, and there continue to be. Yeah.
Again, not detracting from anything that you said. The reason I sent the link that I did is because this story is completely 100% about women and completely not. Political allegory. I also think there's a reason why the story begins and ends with the same statement. I think the reason that you don't have long explanations of what happened to the women is because everyone who wrote it and everyone who read it would have known exactly what those things meant. They all would have known the vulnerability of women, the crimes perpetrated against them, the way they were treated, how their lives played out, so that you didn't need to write all that because people would have known. It's not necessarily dismissing the cruelty to women, because that's the whole point. The story tells you about a vulnerable person within a home who turns to her extended family, and her vulnerability doesn't stop. Neither does the town help, or adjoining towns, or the nation. So the vulnerability or weakness of a person in a home, or if it's completely allegorical tale politically, you know, a community doesn't function, this happens wider, you end up with war and end up with all this happening. If you just follow that track of the women, you end up with one woman vulnerable and mistreated. And you end with tens of thousands of women vulnerable and mistreated. Go back to the beginning of the story. Because it's a cycle.
But historically, that's not what the culture did. But historically, the culture did not read it that way. Historically, it embedded patriarchy. It did not embed care for women.
Yes. Doesn't mean that the story solved any problem.
Yeah. And this is
happening today, either if you look at the sad status of women or nations or communities or whatever. But the story didn't fix anything.
This is why, for me, it doesn't make a great deal of difference if this exact event historically happened, because if it is all right for a culture to tell a story of this happening as part of how we teach each other what's right and wrong, then I think that's still a problem. If we have mythological women who we invent to be raped, abused, and used as tokens of political statement, that is still not okay, because that still shapes who we are and how we relate to real people. And the story, chapter 20 is the story of the wars, and I've read a lot of history, and I really find war history extremely difficult to read, because so much of war history is a blow by blow, and then they went over the next hill and they lined up in this direction, and it was really important for this reason, but there was this other thing, and they used this particular sort of machinery, but that was really cool. And chapter 20 is exactly like that. It's describing the Benjaminite War like that. They had an ambush, and then they retreated, and then they had a think, and then they went, and then they had went the other way, and then they set a smoke on fire to tell a signal. And it's like that. It's not that they knew about the women, they didn't know about the war. It's that they liked telling war stories. Sorry.
And that still happens now, that any time you have a message that protects women, you've got to masculinize it so that the men will read it.
Sorry, Tricia.
Thanks, Claire. Thanks for pointing out that beginning about Israel had no king and therefore people did as they wish, and the people at the end. Because for me, that takes me to the conversation that Samuel has with God just a little bit further down the track, where Samuel is talking to God about anointing a king, and Samuel's concerned and saying, king's going to do all these terrible things, and God says it's not you that the people have rejected, it's me. So effectively this is an illustration of what's happened when the people have already rejected God as the king.
the sort of moral depravity and the misbehaviour and all the other horrible things that go from actually rejecting God as their king, and then further along the track they decide that they need a human king, which of course doesn't fit.
And it's disturbing that the thing that was seen particularly as morally depraved is not necessarily the attack on the woman, it's the attack on the man's property is really what's seen, and he paints it like that to the nation, that his property has been desecrated, not that something bad has happened to the woman. You're all remarkable people that I can stand up. I just want to say this. You are remarkable people that would turn up when I told you in advance I was going to talk about this, and graciously listen to that. That's really heavy, and please be kind to yourself going home with that, because that's a lot to sit with. I think we need to look and not turn away, but we need to be kind to each other as we look as well.
And I would like to say thank you for having the courage to talk about something that all of us find disgusting and don't want to look at. Like, you've had the courage to talk to us and make us think about it and think through it and do something constructive with it. So thank you.
Okay.
I'd just like to say I'm very thankful that we have a community of so many men who can listen and think and be with us through these problems.
And for me, as a woman standing up to speak about this, I am very confident that even if we were having coffee, I would not be backed into a corner by any of the men of this community to have a go at me about my right to say that. And I couldn't say that for many, many places I might... Well, most of them I wouldn't say that to talk because of that. But there's lots of places where it would be really personally frightening for me to talk like that because of the consequences over coffee and the consequences on the internet in the week to come if I said that. So thank you.